This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Joe Biden said Sunday the U.S.-led evacuation of Americans at risk, Afghans and others from the Kabul airport accelerated this weekend, although it remains vulnerable to threats posed by the Islamic State extremist group. A week after the Taliban completed its takeover of Afghanistan by capturing Kabul, Biden said discussions are underway among military officials about potentially extending the airlift beyond Biden's August 31st deadline. He said the hope is that we will not have to extend, but there are discussions. He said suggesting the possibility that the Taliban will be consulted. Since August 14th, a day before the Taliban entered Kabul, the airlift has evacuated 28,000 people. He said that included 11,000 who had departed from Kabul in a 36-hour period over the weekend. After addressing the evacuation in Afghanistan, Biden noted that the Islamic State poses a threat as American troops seek to evacuate thousands of U.S. citizens and Afghan allies. He said that the longer U.S. troops are on the ground increases the chance that the group will attempt to strike innocent civilians and American personnel near the Hamid Karzai International Airport. The extremist group has long declared a desire to attack American and U.S. interests abroad and has been active in Afghanistan for a number of years, carrying out waves of horrific attacks, mostly on the Shiite minority. The group has been repeatedly targeted by U.S. airstrikes in recent years and faced Taliban attacks. U.S. soldiers set up over 70 military locations and at the tents at Germany's Ramstein Air Base as they prepare to shelter up to 10,000 evacuees from Afghanistan. The current capacity of that base is about 5,000 people. This is VOA News. Russian President Vladimir Putin said on Sunday that the conflict in Afghanistan directly affects the security situation in Russia. Putin criticized an idea of some Western countries to send refugees from Afghanistan to neighboring Central Asian countries while their visas to the United States and Europe are being processed. He said Russia does not want Afghanistan militants arriving under cover of refugees. The White House on Monday announced a series of new agreements with Singapore aimed at combating cyber threats, tackling climate change, addressing the COVID-19 pandemic, and alleviating supply chain issues. The announcements coincide with Vice President Kamala Harris's visit to the region as part of Biden's administration's efforts to counter Chinese influence there. Harris has been visiting Singapore and Vietnam this week with the goal of strengthening U.S. ties with Southeast Asia. German Chancellor Angela Merkel offered reassurances Sunday that Ukraine would not suffer from the construction of Russia's Nord Stream 2 pipeline. On her final visit to Kiev before retiring as chancellor next month, Merkel said gas should not be used as a geopolitical weapon, but Russia and Germany could impose new sanctions on Moscow if necessary. Germany has given financial assistance and diplomatic backing to Ukraine since Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014 and the outbreak of war in the eastern Donbass region between Ukrainian troops and Russian-backed forces in the same year. In Israel's COVID-19 wards, doctors are learning which vaccinated patients are most vulnerable to severe illness amid growing concerns about instances in which shots provide less protection against the worst forms of the disease. Around half of the country's 600 patients presently hospitalized with severe illness have received two doses of the Pfizer Inc. shot, a rare occurrence out of 5.4 million fully vaccinated people. The majority of these patients received two vaccine doses at least 5 months ago and are over the age of 60 and also have chronic illnesses known to exacerbate a coronavirus infection. The Reverend Jesse Jackson and his wife Jacqueline remained under doctor's observation Sunday at a Chicago hospital and were responding positively to treatments for COVID-19, according to their son. The couple married for nearly six decades were admitted to the hospitals a day earlier. Physicians were carefully monitoring their condition because of their ages, according to Jonathan Jackson, one of the couple's five children. Jesse Jackson is 79 and Jacqueline is 77. There is more at voanews.com. Again, voanews.com via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, August 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda vows to continue helping South Sudan parties until peace is achieved.
For us, Uganda, we are concerned that all of the parties in this agreement must be able to fulfill their responsibilities.
Zambia's Law Association says the outgoing president has constitutional backing to free prisoners. Major players in Kenya's Build the Bridges initiatives react to a court ruling on the issue. And Rwanda deports Paul Rusesabagina's Belgian lawyer.
The visa that he was accorded is the V1 type, is the visitor's visa, which allows the bearer to visit the country but not conduct any remunerated work, any employment.
And Malawi farmers are concerned about rising fertilizer prices. Those stories plus Samson Omale's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Uganda's Foreign Minister General Alhaji Abubakar Odongo Jeje says President Yoweri Museveni's administration is working with all stakeholders in South Sudan to resolve the challenges facing the youngest African country. Implementation of South Sudan's 2018 revitalized comprehensive peace agreement has been a difficult task due to disagreement between the two main parties to the agreement. Foreign Minister Odongo Jeje tells VOA's Peter Clotty via Skype that Uganda will continue to offer support to ensure South Sudan's stability and progress.
For us, Uganda, we are concerned that all of the parties in this agreement must be able to fulfill their responsibilities. So as we are speaking now, we are on a trajectory of a return to the negotiating table, a return to each party fulfilling its responsibility in implementing the revitalized peace agreement in as far as it was signed.
Well, Mr. Foreign Minister, there have been concerns that in spite of the engagement of IGAD, in spite of your president, President Museveni, acting as mediator and speaking with stakeholders in South Sudan, it appears there seemed to be no way forward. What do you think can be done to ensure the full implementation of these peace agreements signed previously so South Sudanese citizens can operate their businesses and can live freely without any fear of danger or being attacked by anybody?
That's true. I have had opportunity to interact with various authorities, both inside South Sudan as well as representatives of the United Nations Secretary General in South Sudan on this matter. And what has become apparent and clear is that we may require to move in the direction of lifting sanctions that were imposed on South Sudan in order to free them to be able to maneuver and do a little more in order to establish peace and security in that part of the world.
Moving forward, Mr. Foreign Minister, what is the way forward for South Sudan in your view as Foreign Minister?
First of all, the greatest ingredient in peace for South Sudan, and indeed for many countries, is the ability of the country to govern itself. If South Sudan does not have the instruments and tools to do so, peace may not be there. So first and foremost, we would like everybody to help South Sudan to establish a unified military force with a unified command, which will then be able to give government the muscle and the ability to implement many other activities. We would like everyone to encourage and to assist South Sudan to do that. Then we can speak of an instrument that government can use in order to be able to establish peace and security, and other activities can then follow.
Thank you very much, Mr. Foreign Minister, for speaking with the Voice of America News.
My pleasure indeed.
That was Ugandan Foreign Minister General Alhaji Abubakar Odongo Jeje speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty via Skype. As Zambians gear up for tomorrow, Tuesday's inauguration of President-elect Hakainde Hichilema, the pardons announced last week by lame duck President Edgar Lungu have been generating widespread public debate. President Lungu last Thursday pardoned about 60 prisoners. However, some Zambians question some of those pardoned because they say they are cases were high profile and were still pending before the courts. Abiwude James Shonga is the president of the Law Association of Zambia, a non-partisan statutory body that encourages adherence to the rule of law. He says outgoing President Lungu's pardons are supported by the Zambian constitution.
What we said in that article is that during the transitional period, that is between time that the Electoral Commission of Zambia has announced that a person has won the presidential election and inauguration, between that period, the president does continue to have a certain constitutional powers, the power to make new appointments. And we concluded that even during the transition period, the president of the Republic of Zambia, the outgoing president, does have the power to exercise the prerogative of mercy. But this is subject, of course, to the provisional requirement of advice being given to him by the advisory committee, which is also provided for in the constitution.
With these pardons and with the constitutional backing, is there a limitation to what the president can do as a lame duck president?
Yes, there are limitations. He cannot make appointments because his role right now is merely to wait as he exits after the inauguration, which and the new president comes in. So there is a piece of legislation in Zambia, which is Act Number 32 of 2016, which deals with a transition. And in that piece of law, there is power given to a committee, which is simply called the Inauguration Committee. This committee is headed by the Secretary to the Cabinet. The committee is responsible for certain statutorily allocated functions during the period of transition.
Some Zambians say that some of the pardons are questionable. For example, in the case of Chishimba Kambwili, who was charged with 3 counts of forgery, and he's released on bail. Some say that he has even fomented tribal hatred.
There's a lot of public sentiment. As you are aware, people are talking a lot about his pardon. And as the Law Association of Zambia, what we have done is focused our statement on the legal provisions surrounding a pardon. Now, all of these matters to do with who gets pardoned are the preserve of the advisory committee. That is our law in this country. The advisory committee is the one that sits, deliberates, and comes to the conclusion as to who they will recommend for reasons that they have, and then they make that recommendation. If you are going to speak about the law, the question will really be, was there a recommendation for the persons that have been released made by the advisory committee? That is the focus of the Law Association of Zambia. You see, now whether these pardons have benefited people who the public believe were not perhaps meritorious, because there will be views from different sections depending on what agendas that people are driving.
Thank you so much, sir.
My pleasure.
Abiwude James Shonga is president of the Law Association of Zambia, a non-partisan statutory body that encourages adherence to the rule of law. He was speaking with us from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. The Rwandan government on Saturday deported a Belgian lawyer who it says was illegally conducting legal services in Rwanda. Vincent Lorkin is a Belgian lawyer said to be one of the lawyers representing Paul Rusesabagina, who was arrested by the Rwandan government a year ago and has been on trial for charges including terror activities. Yuji Uwimana has details from Kigali.
Rwandan traffic police Saturday drove Belgian lawyer Vincent Lorkin Ferdinand to the airport to deport him on the next flight home after being declared persona non grata. Addressing journalists in Kigali, the Director General of Rwanda Immigration and Emigration, Lieutenant Colonel Regis Gatalaiha, said Vincent Lorkin Ferdinand flouted the Rwandan immigration laws.
He has been here since the 16th of August. He was allowed entry into the country on the basis of his declared purpose of visit, and he was accorded entry for 30 days from the 16th of August. The visa that he was accorded is the V1 type, is the visitor's visa, which allows the bearer to visit the country but not conduct any remunerated work, any employment.
Last Friday, Vincent put on a legal gown and went into the courtroom as a lawyer. Photos of him sitting with the lawyer of Paul Rusesabagina, Katela Kashabana, circulated on social media. Rwanda Bar Association announced on Twitter that it did not give Vincent Larkin authorization to perform legal services on Rwandan territory. A part of the tweet reads, Rwanda Bar Association notes Vincent Larkin today appeared in court as a lawyer in a lawyer's gown. Although he is not a member of the Rwandan Bar Association and is not allowed to practice in Rwanda, he has been requested to explain his behavior. Rwanda's Directorate of Immigration and Emigration says Larkin knowingly violated the law because his request to get authorization was denied by the bar.
We were surprised to see that he appeared in court in one of the proceedings of the court in an attire that shows that he was really practicing as an advocate, which he was not allowed to do. For him to be able to do that, he was supposed to get a clearance from the Bar Association of Rwanda. And after that, he was supposed to come to immigration to secure a work permit. We had to check whether he had been permitted or accredited by the Bar Association and received confirmation that he has not secured that accreditation. He did it on purpose because he tried to get that accreditation, and the feedback from the Bar Association was that, no, you are not allowed to do that because we don't have such arrangement with the Bar Association of the Belgium.
In one of his court hearings, Paul Rusesabagina challenged the court's jurisdiction, saying that because he is a Belgian by nationality, he should be tried in Belgium. The verdict in the case of Paul Rusesabagina and his co-accused was supposed to have been rendered last Friday, but the court delayed it. The High Court Chamber for International and Cross-Border Crimes adjourned the trial to 20th September 2021. Eugene Uwimana for VOA Daybreak Africa, Kigali, Rwanda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, August 23rd. In Kenya, some of the major players in the Building Bridges Initiative, the BBI, have been speaking out following Friday's appeals court ruling declaring the BBI amendment unconstitutional. The court upheld a ruling by the Kenyan High Court permanently sealing its fit to amend the 2010 constitution. As Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, there have been mixed reactions to the court ruling from Kenyans of all calibers.
The seven-judge appellate court headed by Justice Daniel Musinga ruled that it was against the constitution for President Uhuru Kenyatta to initiate changes to the constitution through the popular initiative route, which is only reserved for the citizens of the parliament.
The president does not have authority under the constitution to initiate changes to the constitution, and that a constitutional amendment can only be initiated by parliament through a parliamentary initiative under Article 256 or through a popular initiative under Article 257 of the Constitution.
The Building Bridges Initiative was born when President Kenyatta and opposition leader Raila Odinga had a truce in 2018 after protracted violence following the 2017 general elections. Odinga conceded the verdict and said he will not appeal at the Supreme Court. Instead, he urged Kenyans to move on and shift focus to preparations for the 2022 general elections, where he would be contesting for presidency for the fifth time. Odinga spoke on Saturday in his first reaction to the court ruling while attending a funeral in Western Kenya.
We respect the court ruling because that is their job. They studied the case and made that decision. We are used to such court decisions. BBI ruling is just a minor setback, but we move on regardless. We now shift our focus to the upcoming election.
Deputy President William Ruto, who some say no longer reads from the same script as his boss, President Kenyatta, and has been a BBI opponent from the onset, approved Friday's court ruling and lauded the judiciary for being independent. While addressing journalists on Saturday from his Nairobi home, Ruto said the Court of Appeals decision proves that Kenya is governed by the rule of law and not the rule of men.
The court decision reaffirms that Kenya is a country governed by the rule of law, not the rule of men, where the constitution and the sovereignty of the people are supreme and not the political elite. However, no one has lost and no one has won. It is a win-win for both the people and the constitution. I laud the courage of the judges who have bravely defended the constitution. God bless them.
Ordinary Kenyans have also been expressing their views on the ruling. 35-year-old businessman from Nairobi, Daniel Kimani, says he approves the ruling because since the onset of BBI, the government's attention has shifted from more important matters like cushioning Kenyans from the hard economic times occasioned by the COVID-19 pandemic. Kimani urges the government to use the resources that has been allocated for the BBI referendum to revive the economy.
I'm very happy with the Friday ruling on the BBI. Since the onset of this BBI, the government has been pushing for it, forgetting other important aspects such as the citizens and also how we can revive our citizens from the ash effects of the pandemic. But now that the BBI has been ruled out, I'm urging the government to please use the money that had been set aside for the referendum.
If it had passed, the BBI would, among others, expand the executive structure by introducing the post of Prime Minister and two Deputy Prime Minister positions. According to BBI proponents, the changes are necessary to provide a long-lasting solution to recurrent divisive politics experienced in Kenya after every election. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
Farmers in Malawi say the rise in fertilizer prices is likely to affect production in this agro-business Southern Africa country. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Jacob Onyirongo is Chief Executive Officer for Farmers Union of Malawi.
Most farmers in Malawi are poor, and it's quite a struggle for farmers to access fertilizer, even at the prices that they were like last year. And so with the increase that we have seen this year, that means it is pushing more farmers to a bracket where most farmers won't be able to access fertilizer.
Fertilizer prices have hit an all-time high in Malawi, with a bag weighing 50 kilograms now selling between $40 and $50. This is almost double the prices of last year. Agriculture experts say this would likely to lead to higher costs for government-subsidized fertilizers under the Affordable Inputs Program, in which ultra-poor farmers buy at $6 per 50 kilogram. But in his national televised address Saturday, President Chakwera vowed to keep the prices low. He said the price hike is the result of actions by a cartel, which he did not name, and accused it of trying to undermine his Affordable Inputs Program. He says, but what I want you to know is that I and my government cannot allow someone to kill agriculture in this country. Whether one likes it or not, farmers will buy fertilizers at a cheaper price this year. He, however, said the prices might be slightly higher than last year's, but not as exorbitant as they are now. But the Fertilizer Importers Association in Malawi, a group of fertilizer importers, justifies the current price rise. Speaking in Malawi Parliament Wednesday, the group said the rise is dictated by the international market, which is facing the rise in fertilizer raw materials like phosphate. In response to the rise in fertilizer prices, the Ministry of Agriculture announced in July that it has trimmed the number of beneficiaries of the subsidized farm input program this year from 3.7 million to 2.7 million. But Chakwera has reversed that. He says, I will not allow anyone to remove any family or village from the list of beneficiaries of the cheap fertilizer. If there are people I vowed to fight for, they are the farmers. Dr. Bechani Cheleni is a lecturer in economics at Malawi University of Business and Applied Sciences. He says farmers should do organic farming, which largely relies on manure.
This organic way of farming is the way to go. We just need to propagate it to make sure that everyone understands the house, what is the best way of doing it. Once we do that way, I think the issues of biodiversity, they will come in, and I'm very, very sure that at the end of the day, we are going to benefit as a country economically and also in terms of our own health.
But Farmers Union's Milongo, also an agronomist, says manure cannot stand alone.
So what we have seen as farmers is that if you use manure, you improve the health of the soil and you enable the soil to utilize the fertilizer that you apply to a crop. So if, for example, you combine manure with inorganic fertilizer, you get the best yield.
That was reporter Lamek Masina in Blantyre, Malawi. It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with the World Athletics Under 20 Championships in Nairobi, which ended on Sunday. The championships recorded 4 World Under 20 records, 15 championships records, 11 area Under 20 records, 68 national Under 20 records, and 10 national senior records. The final day of the championships saw Jamaican women and the South African men broke the Under 20 records in the 4x100 meters. Relays, the home team Kenya topped the medal table with 8 gold, 1 silver, and 7 bronze medals ahead of Finland with 4 gold, 1 silver. Nigeria came third with 4 gold and 3 bronze medals, while Ethiopia was fourth with 3 golds, 7 silver, and 2 bronze medals. In other fascinating statistics from the World Under 20 Championships, shows that from more than 100 countries that competed in Nairobi, 18 teams won gold medals, 35 won medals, and 63 had top 8 finishes. Nigerian athletics reporter Deji Ogembo, who is in Nairobi, tells me the championship was highly successful.
Well, the championships has been massive for world athletics. It was on the verge of being cancelled because of the COVID pandemic. Nairobi was given the hosting rights in 2018 after they successfully hosted the World Youth Championships in 2018. They've done a decent job, to be honest. In terms of quality of participation, a bit sad. Some of the top countries, like the United States, pulled out due to COVID concerns. Same as Great Britain, too. Again, Germany also not participating, and Australia. But it hasn't taken much gloss out of the competition itself.
All is now set for the 30th edition of the FIBA AfroBasket 2021 Championship that is scheduled to take place in Kigali Arena in Rwanda. The AfroBasket tournament will get underway on Tuesday, August 24th, with 16 teams competing. Reigning African champions and second-ranked side on the continent, Tunisia heads to the tournament as one of the favorites. But as head coach of the Tunisian basketball team, Dirk Boerman explains, they are not leaving anything to chance.
So I think we are one of the teams that has a chance, but a lot of things have to go right. We have to stay healthy. We have to play well in the big games, make big shots, make big plays. In a 10-day tournament, anything can happen.
Another team heading to Kigali is Kenya. The East African country is making a return to the AfroBasket after a 28-year absence. Congolese international Fabrice Nsakala, who collapsed on Saturday while playing for his Turkish side, Besiktas, is said to be recuperating. The defender is recovering in hospital after he collapsed on the pitch in their meeting with Gaziantepspor on Saturday. That's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, August 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson Omale, along with all our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you will have a wonderful week.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa news. Tune in on the top of each hour 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.